You are listening to the Humane Podcast. Humane is your first look at the startups and industry titans that are leading and disrupting artificial intelligence, data science, future of work, and developer education. I am your host, David Jacobovich, and you are listening to Humane. If you like this episode, remember to subscribe and leave a review. Now, on to the show. Listeners, welcome back to the Humane Podcast. Today, I have a special guest on our show, Heaven Rees, who works at the Francis Crick Institute in the United Kingdom. He's a researcher and scientist, and also a new author of a machine learning book with Manning Publications called Machine Learning with R, Tidyverse, and MLR, which goes live in just a couple weeks. Heaven, thank you so much for being with us on Humane.
Thank you very much for having me. It's nice to be here. Thank you. Hello, everyone.
Oh, this is so fun, you know, because there's so much going on in the world. And, you know, we offline were just speaking before the episode about coronavirus. And that is not a topic that's fun. It's a topic that is very serious. And as if it's the only topic the world has been talking about for the past 2 months. Now, you're a researcher traditionally, and you've actually worked a lot in biology and medical systems. I wanted to hear your take on what's going on with the coronavirus around research.
Sure. I mean, I want to caveat this by saying that I'm not a virologist or an epidemiologist. So my view is not that of someone who is an expert on this virus. But I mean, it's clearly something that's very serious and that we need to take serious and sort of treat with respect. But having said that, I think because it's new, it's likely transmitted from a bat, it makes for a very cool and sort of sexy and mysterious and worrying news story. And so as much as the virulence of the virus itself is concerning, I think of particular concern is how viral misinformation and sort of misinformed practice has gone along with it. So, for example, I think health bodies around the world have basically said that, you know, wearing face masks is very unlikely to prevent you from contracting COVID-19. And that actually, I also heard that somebody suggested, or a study suggested, that wearing face masks could even increase your likelihood of contracting it. And these sort of panic measures that people go through, you know, buying face masks or panic stocking up on foods and supplies because they think, you know, this is going to be sort of a T virus or, you know, result in such extreme impact on the population. It does obviously kill people in it, and people have sadly died from it. I think the people that have died have largely been older people, people with underlying health conditions already, or people that have been immunocompromised. For the vast majority of people that are healthy and have strong functioning immune systems, you know, if you contract COVID-19, you're going to feel pretty rubbish. I mean, you get symptoms very similar to the flu, but it's very unlikely to kill you. And this is the other thing that really we need to sort of ground ourselves and remember, is that the strains of influenza that we sort of already know about and live, you know, with in our communities, you know, you have colleagues, friends, family who get flu sometimes. Those strains are much more prevalent, infect so many more people and have higher mortality rates than COVID-19. I think one of the reasons why we're talking about it so much and why it is such a big deal is that COVID-19 is particularly virulent. It is easily transmittable more than influenza. But it's important for the sake of people's health, as much as anything, to just remain grounded and not panic and just stay calm and monitor the disease and to implement practices that actually stop the spread. So rather than issuing face masks, which, you know, take away face masks from medical professionals, as we've had in the UK, we've had shortages for people that actually need them, is just implementing hand washing techniques. Hand washing is the most effective way to prevent the transmission of COVID-19. So as far as research goes, I can't comment an awful lot because here at the Francis Crick, it's not actually a project that I'm aware of that we are researching, but I know a number of institutes and hospitals around the world looking for a vaccine. But it's an influenza virus, so it's not going to be something that's going to be cured. And for the vast majority of us, if you contract it, it may just be a case of letting it run its course until you feel better. And self-isolating, of course, you know, if you feel like you have flu-like symptoms, whether it is just a normal flu, just don't go to work, don't go to school, you know, self-isolate, prevent others from getting ill as well. Speak to your local healthcare providers and seek advice. But yeah, that's kind of my non-virologist take on the current situation. And actually, I'm going to complain again. I don't know if people were here earlier. I'm going to complain about what is otherwise an absolutely beautiful dashboard. And I do love a lovely dashboard. But the black and red, it evokes sort of Walking Dead sort of feelings of pandemics and end of the world vibes.
That's right. You know, I've been working with students lately on some capstone projects. We've been using both the Python and R programming languages. And one of the groups said they want to work on the coronavirus COVID-19 project. And I said to them, all right, well, you know, I actually had an article that came out a few weeks ago on Medium where I was talking about how to fight the coronavirus with AI and data science. And by this point, many people might know that Blue Dot Global is, you know, the big company out in Toronto that's been the same company actually that predicted a lot for both SARS and Ebola and other conditions. But, you know, I said to this team that's wanting to work at Python R, I said, what data is available? You know, I think where we are in 2020 is everyone gets so exciting, you know, when you go through and you see, wow, Harvard's working on this. You know, yes, people are wearing face masks. There's so much you can do, like just like you mentioned, quarantine yourself to stave off a global pandemic. But it's really not just that. It's all about the data, right? Mm-hmm. And so you need to be able to have data to extract insights. And when we, you know, look at dashboards, whether they're from Johns Hopkins University or the Ministry of Health in Singapore, which has a similar one as well, and even the Korean government, their Ministry of Health recently made public their data, it's so sparse. There is not that much information available. And so the students I work with say, I want to do all this great feature analysis. I want to do all these great visualizations. If Johns Hopkins can do it, I can do it too. And I say, yes, you can. And you need data. And I think that's one of the big challenges we're experiencing in 2020, which I'd love to dive deeper with you during our show, is about, you know, as a new author, the work that you're focusing on is in the R programming language. And whether it's for healthcare or social scientists or any type of researchers, I know that you focus generally on three major areas of R in your book, the tidyverse, Tibble, and MLR. You know, when we look at these packages, they all do something so unique and different and very different in their own respect than Python, but they're not all machine learning. There's a lot more to the packages than that. Can you share with our listeners a little bit about your inspiration of why you've come out with this book to start with? And then we'll dive deeper into some of those topics.
Yeah, absolutely. So I feel like I should start by caveating or apologizing almost, because I am an outsider. I should really put that straight out there. I am not a computer scientist and I am not a machine learning researcher. So why have I got any business writing a book like this? So I work in life sciences. I studied as a pharmacologist, trying to understand how drugs work. And then my PhD was in immunology. And basically, throughout my PhD, the questions that we were asking and the sorts of data and volume of data that we were generating started to mean that the sort of traditional analysis methods that we had been using and that other people in biological fields were using started to not quite suit our needs, not quite answer our questions. So I started working with R. One of the reasons being was that it was free and that I was a poor student. Working with R, learning it from the ground up. And of course, I'm still learning, which I think is true of anyone that uses a programming language. And then starting to learn more about and understand and apply and then get valid answers from machine learning techniques applied to the data. And then the thing in biological life sciences is that the level of maths maths literacy tends not to be always that great, at least in academia. And if you are someone who knows how to code, who knows and understands how to model things with statistics or apply machine learning, you sort of become gold dust. So I started to teach statistics, R, and machine learning during my PhD. And just for accessibility, so that people could either watch again or if they missed my lectures, I'd record them and stick them on YouTube. So I just had a YouTube channel with a few videos on a few different topics to do with data science and or R statistics. And then I got contacted by Manning, who apparently publishers have these people that sort of go around looking for candidates to write books for them, who stumbled on my YouTube channel and asked me if I'd submit a book proposal. And I said, thank you, but there are people that are definitely more qualified than I am to write this book. You know, you probably want to contact the sort of Hadley Wickhams and the data scientists and machine learning engineers. And they said, well, yeah, there are some phenomenal books by those kinds of people, but that we really want a book from the perspective of someone that has come to machine learning and AI and has learned it and applied it to their daily lives, because they really wanted a book that was not for computer scientists necessarily, but more for people who were an expert in their own area, but who could use and benefit from machine learning. So, and also as a slight embarrassment on my part, the book changed names at some point. So you'll notice that the name there that you can see on your screen is no longer the final running title. And so I started writing the book with the view that it would be a book for people who are experts in their own field. So maybe academics, researchers, journalists, economists, maybe people who are experts in their own field and who don't necessarily want to or can't or have the time to become experts in something else. Because, I mean, to become an expert in something takes years, but who could benefit from understanding and learning machine learning to basically make predictions and extract meaningful insights from the data that they have. And I kind of wrote it for myself sort of 10 years ago, thinking about how stupid I was, I don't assume the readers are stupid at all, but I was stupid. For my level of maths understanding and for someone who at that time had, you know, not much knowledge or experience with machine learning. So it's a fun sort of sometimes tongue-in-cheek approach to machine learning that assumes you have some basic knowledge of R, or quite frankly, if you have basic Python skills, I mean, R and Python, you know, you'll be able to pick up R very quickly. So people that maybe have some basic R or Python skills, but who are new to machine learning, and to make things simple and fun, and also to teach a modern approach to machine learning, I teach the tidyverse set of packages that basically help make your data science skills nice and streamlined and allow you to do extremely complex data manipulation and transformation very easily, and also to create beautiful graphics with the ggplot2 package. And then that then makes the machine learning much easier. And the machine learning, I use the MLR package, which gives you a really nice uniform interface to a huge variety of machine learning techniques and approaches. I'm as graphical as I can be, and I present the math as much as possible as a nice to know rather than a need to know. So if, you know, people's math skills, because I'm not fantastic at maths at all. I'm a stereotypical biologist. So if your math skills are not phenomenal, that does not mean that you won't be able to dive into the book and start using these techniques.
I love everything that you've been sharing, Heaven, because similar to yourself, I got started not as a traditional data scientist, but I got started with the Carpentries. And this is an organization that's very much focused with researchers, genomics, ecology, and scientists on, you know, empowering scientific learning with code. And in fact, one of the first workshops that I delivered was all about R with visualization using ggplot2 and analysis. And it was amazing. I was working on this back in, I think, 2014. And I said, oh my goodness, what have I been missing out on using Microsoft Excel when there's this R programming language? Yeah. And it completely rocked my world. And you know, since then, I continue my learning journey, which has been back and forth with R and SQL and Python and other languages, but it's moved very much towards python. But I think this year in 2020 is very special. I think it is a comeback year for R. I think it is a big comeback year. And I wanted to hear, why do you think that is?
R and Python have this very strange relationship, I feel. There is this weird rivalry between which is better, and, you know, proponents of R say that R is better, proponents of Python say that Python is better. And it can be fun and tongue-in-cheek sometimes, but actually I think it can also hurt people's learning sometimes, because, you know, they'll hear from someone, oh, you know, R is rubbish, only use Python. And then they're missing out on some phenomenal data science tools. I think the answer to the question of whether somebody should learn R or Python is yes. People should use either or both. Python is excellent and has boasted some things that I think if you were to look back at R a few years ago, Python would probably have been a more convenient choice for a lot of people for machine learning, for example, or if people were going to end up deploying apps from the projects that they were working on. And one of the things I think that Python would sort of have been considered winning over R for a long time is the phenomenal scikit-learn package, which is amazing and gives you this common interface to a huge number of machine learning tools and algorithms. And the reason that Python had won in that category was because R and having CRAN and the way that people contribute things to R is that basically every machine learning algorithm that was implemented by someone was implemented by someone else in a different package. And these different packages and functions had different interfaces, different arguments. And every time you wanted to learn to apply a new technique, you'd need to read the documentation and learn a new package again. Whereas in scikit-learn, you had this single interface. But then come along packages like Caret or MLR, in R, which were kind of R's answer to scikit-learn, and create this common interface so that you learn how to use that package, and then substituting in a variety of different machine learning techniques and algorithms is extremely simple. And Caret is phenomenal, but my preference and what I wrote about in my book is MLR. Maybe we can talk a little bit about why later. But I think one of the reasons why R is potentially packages like Caret and MLR are helping R make a comeback. I think probably really though, you can put it down to sort of Hadley fever. People like Hadley Wickham and the guys from R Studio and, you know, the other contributors to the Tidyverse packages. If anyone is not aware already what the Tidyverse is, it's a collection of data science packages. No sooner have I said than there's on the screen. A set of packages for R that are designed to make common data science tasks extremely easy, clean, and reproducible. And of course, there's nothing that you could, that in the Tidyverse that you could not do using base R code. But in using the Tidyverse, it makes your code much more readable, much easier, much faster in terms of typing anyway. And so as you can see on your screen there, so the Tidyverse is a set of packages, and the core packages are dplyr, which is for manipulating and transforming your data. So, you know, selecting columns, filtering rows, mutating new columns, things like that. The absolutely famous ggplot2 plotting library is, and I'm a little bit biased, I guess, but is, in my opinion, the best plotting library that there is phenomenal. Reader for reading in data in a tidy format, and Tibble. So if people are familiar with R and reading data into R, you'll be familiar with the data frame structure. Tibble is a package that creates a new data structure called the Tibble that just gets rid of a few of the features that most data scientists dislike about data frames. So, for example, the whole strings as factors thing. When you create Tibbles, you don't have to worry about that. And printing of your data is much nicer. The Tidyr package for converting between long and wide format, and the Pur package, which is phenomenal. It allows you to vectorize your functions. So for loops can be a thing of the past, basically. It's extremely powerful. And so in my book, I dedicate a whole chapter to these tools that hopefully will, you know, one, make people better, faster, and enjoy their data science projects more. And then once people have got those under their belt, then when we move on to the meaty machine learning chapters, we use these tools over and over again, repeatedly, so that people get a real good feel for them. But it's sort of been a bit of a renaissance in R. All these packages coming out, part of the Tidyverse, that R has become very sexy and fashionable again among data scientists. And those sort of traditional differences as well in terms of fields, I think, as to whether certain fields use R or Python, I think, have hung around. So for me, anyway, in sort of academic biology, it's mostly R, at least here in UK. I think because for a lot of people, because R has always sort of had that mission of being a statistical language specifically, it's very, you know, geared specifically towards that. So people that have been doing, you know, maybe basic linear modeling, R has kind of fit that bill. So that's what they've learned and that's what they've gone with. People looking to do, to train neural nets, to do deep learning, I think have traditionally linked towards Python. I think a lot of the deep learning libraries have been interfaced from Python first, but actually now, you know, you can interface with Keras, TensorFlow, H2O within R as well. So there isn't really anything that you can do in one or the other. I mean, Shiny now allows people to create web apps very easily using R, to create dashboards using R. So yeah, I think Tidyverse, I think Shiny, which I hadn't really mentioned, and these unified machine learning interfaces, I think, have played a big role in making R cool again, because I think some had predicted that it would fall by the wayside.
You know, it's amazing to think that Python today has over 200,000 projects, and it's become so big with so many developers, but it's become so scattered, right? And for R, you know, R today has less than 10% of the number of packages from Python, but there's such a unified mission. I think that's what I'm hearing from yourself today, Heaven, that it's all these researchers and scientists collaborating together. I mean, these packages that we're looking at that are provided in the Tidyverse, as someone like myself who's more focused in Python, I mean, to me, it sounds like this is the answer to Matplotlib and Pandas and NumPy and a lot of these visualization and analysis packages that researchers in Python took for granted, but as you mentioned, Heaven, was not always available for those who were solving problems in R. You know, there was great statistical packages, but now it's a complete solution.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I think there's no reason for Python and R to compete really anymore. The people should use whatever they feel more comfortable using, you know, and depending on what your colleagues and what the people in your field use. And then whatever one you start learning, when you get confident in that one, learn the other one. Like my Python skills lag far behind my R skills, but I'm in the process of trying to learn Python because there are useful things that both can do. And of course, you know, we can interface with Python from within R and R Studio, for example. So, you know, we can incorporate code from both languages. Yeah. And actually even, so one of the things that has sort of put me off using Python for some of my projects is that I wasn't a big fan of Matplotlib, but now actually you can even interface with ggplot2 from within Python. So there's really no excuse.
Yeah, it's so amazing how interoperable the languages are getting. I mean, all the latest visualization packages, machine learning packages are basically saying, if you want R, you want Python, we are here to help you to be successful with that. And, you know, I think two of the big ones that have been very state of the art recently, you know, one is Plotly, that's been pretty big in Python space, but has full interoperability with R as well. And then even beyond that, as you mentioned, you could in notebooks or script files do code that is also interoperable between Python and R. And there's a few packages there, but one that's really nice is Reticulate from R Studio. So it's pretty cool to see that developers now have the options to code with either or both without necessarily the concern of being pigeonholed into just a package.
Yeah, absolutely. One thing as well that is very nice about the R. Well, about using R, and I know less than for Python, so maybe I can get you to comment on it, is that R has a phenomenal community of people. You need only to tweet a question or and ask for opinions and hashtag our stats, and you get a ton of really nice supportive answers back. And the huge amount of support on, you know, GitHub or Stack Overflow, it seems like the R community has a sort of one mindset of, you know, let's create useful, helpful packages that are actually going to make a difference to people and help people contribute to those as well. I don't know if Python has a similar feel. I'm not sort of embedded in that community.
It's so interesting because with Python, you know, when you think of the language, you know, although it is so popular, I think the challenge is it's such a distributed language. So you have, you know, people flying drones with Python. You have people who are building web apps with Python and those who are doing statistics and machine learning. So it's so scattered. And I think that's one of the challenges there, you know, and by its nature, that could be one of the reasons that Python does have about, you know, what, more than 10 times as many packages, but that doesn't mean they have as much quality. I think it's really, we need to have quality over quantity.
Yeah, I mean, submitting a package to CRAN, you know, the Comprehensive Archive Network, I think it's not a difficult process at all if you write your package well, but writing a package for it to be submitted on to CRAN has to meet certain criteria. You know, the documentation has to be of a certain quality and laid out in a certain way. The script files have to be laid out and documented in a certain way. So I think the whole CRAN submission process sort of selects for good quality packages, I think. And then, quite frankly, you know, if there are poor packages, I mean, people won't use them. And people are quite happy to, you know, submit pull requests and help contribute to each other's code, which is quite nice. There's an additional repository of R packages called Bioconductor, which is held separately from CRAN, which is specific for, it tends to be bioinformatics type packages, so things for genome sequencing data and that sort of thing. And they have a similar process for, you know, your package has to meet a certain level of Bioconductor. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, I think looking at all this, both with R and Python, I think one of the common threads we're seeing as developers is 2020 open source is making a huge comeback. We're seeing the democratization of machine learning and AI systems. I mean, one of the core packages that you mentioned you're featuring in your book is MLR. And MLR is, you could say, it is the answer to scikit-learn, right? It's R's way to go all in and say, you know, we can do it just as good as you can. So can you tell our listeners a little bit about why you think R is democratizing data science and how MLR is part of that process?
Yeah, so I think the people that are asking the really important questions, you know, whether to do with business or science or health or whatever, the people that know how to ask and are asking those important questions are the ones that should be able to harness and implement statistics, data science, and machine learning to get those answers. I don't think that machine learning should be the purview only of mathematicians and computer scientists. I know that people get scared by this, and there is sort of a gatekeeping argument to be made to say, you know, you can do a lot of harm, actually, if you employ these techniques and you don't do it in a way that is ethical, or you don't do it in a way where you validate your results properly. But I really strongly think that as long as you teach people how to do things properly, that they have enough of an understanding of how the techniques work and what they do and what they don't do, then absolutely we can democratize machine learning and make it so that, you know, researchers can identify the patients that are at higher risk of contracting COVID-19. So, you know, for example, my book is not going to train the next generation of machine learning researchers. You know, from reading my book, people are not going to be designing self-driving cars or, you know, swapping Obama's face onto the body of another actor or you know, that sort of thing. But we can absolutely teach people to be able to use these techniques to extract the answers or make the predictions that they're looking for in their field of expertise. And I spend a lot of time in the book showing people how to properly validate their models. And we do it again and again and again. And that is really important. The MLR package, which stands for Machine Learning in R, funnily enough, is, I mean, when I discovered it, it kind of changed my world. It's phenomenal. As you said, I think it is kind of R's answer to scikit-learn, along with the carrot package. And it provides a unified interface to a huge number of not only actual machine learning algorithms, but also think processes and functions like missing value, imputation, hyperparameter tuning, validation techniques. And when you're setting up a project or to run an analysis with MLR, the basic run-through is that you create a task. And the task is simply a definition of the data sets that you're working with. And if you are performing a supervised machine learning task, you also define the target. So you tell it which variable or variables you're hoping to predict from the data. So you define your task. The second step is that you define your learner. And the learner is simply a definition of what algorithm you are going to learn to try to learn the patterns in your data, along with then any options or hyperparameters that you want to supply to that. And the way that MLR has been written is so that it already comes with a huge array of well-known machine learning algorithms, you know, from things like K-nearest neighbors to XGBoost. You can interface deep learning models with it. But the way it's been written is that it is meant to be very easy for anyone, you know, if you have a function that is defines the way that a machine learning algorithm works, you can implement your own function. And actually, you can also implement your own performance metrics and other things in it as well. So it's extremely extendable. So once you've defined your task, your learner, you then simply combine the two to train your model. So those three steps are present in any kind of workflow with MLR. And it sort of sounds a little bit cumbersome, but it's really useful because if you define a single machine learning task, so, you know, I supply my data and I supply maybe my target variable is a categorical variable stating whether somebody was infected by COVID-19, for example, you can then, with that one task definition, you can benchmark a huge number of different algorithms against that same task. Or alternatively, if you define a task, you can then benchmark that one task across, benchmark that one learner against a large variety of different tasks. So it allows you to set up machine learning experiments to test how different algorithms perform on different settings. I mean, that's fine. That's easy. I mean, you can do that quite easily with other packages like Carrot, or you could do this manually. I think where MLR particularly shines is it makes it extremely simple to validate your models, for example. So whether you're performing holdout validation or you're doing more complicated things like nested K-fold cross-validation, it's extremely simple to set that up. You could set up a tenfold a nested cross-validation with 10 inner folds and 3 outer folds or whatever that you want to do. And it allows you very easily to incorporate any data-dependent pre-processing steps inside your validation. So I think one of the mistakes that a lot of people make when they start training some complex machine learning models is that they do things like missing value imputation, maybe hyperparameter tuning, maybe feature selection, and they don't include that inside their model validation. And so when they finally validate their model, they get an inflated sense of how good that their model is going to perform. And MLR allows you to create these wrapper functions that allow you to include as many pre-processing steps as you want inside the validation. So, you know, say in the simple case, you split your data into a simple train, test, validation set. It will perform all of those processes for you during training and then test and validate your data. And if you're doing something more complicated like nested cross-validation, it'll ensure that, for example, if you're tuning a hyperparameter, for example, all those different hyperparameter values that you test across will be given the same test set, for example. So it makes these things very easy. You can also parallelize your code with the help of the parallel package in R. So if you're training models that are quite intense, MLR works very nicely with parallelization. That's a surprisingly hard word to say. And I'm a very lazy person. I like to achieve as much as I can in my data science projects with as little code as possible. And MLR helps me achieve that because you can do some extremely complicated validation pre-processing with very small amount of code.
I'm a lazy learner as well. I enjoy preparing and planning. And for those of us who are listeners who are data scientists, when I say lazy learner, you might know what I'm talking about. But for the rest of us, it's all about planning, preparation, getting those computational graphs set up. You know, look, it sounds like MLR definitely is the answer, right, to scikit-learn. But I wanted to briefly dive into those other packages you mentioned and that I've mentioned that are still around. And, you know, if someone's looking to learn R, you know, why would they want to consider picking up Caret? So what's your take on Caret?
I mean, Caret is excellent. I've spent some time working, well, okay, so I've not spent as much time working with Caret as I have MLR. But Caret is very nice. Caret has functions that you can use to split your data into train, test, validation sets. That's quite nice. You can use it to interface with a huge number of machine learning models, and you can also extend it to include other packages as well. And it has functions for, it has the ability for you to perform data pre-processing steps like missing value imputation and things like that. And you can use it to also include those things inside your validation. But if you're doing some very complicated validation, I find it a bit more cumbersome to use. I also find setting up ensembling much easier in MLR. So it's funny, when you look at tutorials for either bagging or boosting, people always just talk about decision trees because they've had a lot of success, and that's where those famous algorithms are. But of course, like we all know that you can use bagging and boosting for algorithms other than decision trees. And with MLR, you can set up ensembles of whatever machine learning model that you want to. And you can combine different algorithms within your same ensembling if you want to. I don't think this is quite as easy inside Caret. MLR also has a nice system of plotting your tuning procedures. For example, if you're performing hyperparameter tuning, it's very simple. You simply pass the tuning results to its functions and it plots the tuning data for you. But both are useful. I think MLR has become a little bit more popular recently. I think Caret has been sort of the mainstay. It's been there for a long time. It's very good. There's nothing that you can do in MLR that you can't do using Caret. So it sort of comes back again to the sort of, well, you know, do I need to use one or the other? I think if I was to compare the ease of use and readability, I think MLR would win for me anyway. I mean, if people are used to writing in Caret, give MLR a go and see whether you prefer its interface. I also find benchmarking in MLR a lot easier and nicer. You simply give it the task, you give it a list of learners and run the function, and it benchmarks all of those against the same task. And importantly, provides each with the same training set and test set partition as well, so you get a nice accurate estimate of how each model is performed.
So I'm going to make a bet here for the first time on Humane. So what I'm hearing is similar to in Python, where scikit-learn and PyTorch have just taken over all machine learning from research to implementation, we're seeing that in MLR as a rise of an awesome package to basically be that one-stop shop. Caret will still be around, but also the final package I wanted to hear your take on today is a newcomer to the space. And I know it wasn't featured much in your book, but a lot of people are talking about it in the R community. I wanted to hear, what do you think about tidy models?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is very nice. So this is actually also a set of packages that comes from the Tidyverse. And in a similar way to the, in that MLR is trying to create a uniform interface to machine learning, Tidy Models is a package that is trying to create a unified approach to modeling in general. So that this includes, and I think is probably more widely used as linear modeling. So to create a unified interface to, you know, whether people are using the LM function for linear modeling in R, or whether people are using the BRMS package for Bayesian modeling. I don't really talk about it much in my book. The reason being is that the way that MLR learns models is a little bit different, and that if you want to get the actual R model object out of your final MLR object. You need to extract that first. But if people are training models, the parsnip function that is part of Tidal models gives you a unified interface to modeling. So no matter what kind of, for example, linear model that you're modeling, you don't have to memorize, you know, the different functions and arguments that you might need for, you know, say, for example, if you're fitting a regularized linear model, then compare that to the whatever package or function you might use to fit a non-regularized linear model. So parsnip is a function is a package that allows you to keep the syntax the same. The dials package is, again, part of Tidy Models that is designed for tuning parameters. And so with parsnip, you can use dials to tune hyperparameters if you're searching a parameter space. And the way that the models are output is in a tidy format. So if people are used to using the LM linear model function in R, you'll know that if you call your object, you get a lot of information printed out, but it's not very tidy. It's sort of in a strange layout that I think was deemed to be visually or aesthetically pleasing when the function was written, but now is not very convenient to extract particular things from. So, for example, if you want to extract, you know, particular coefficients or confidence in intervals from your model output, it's not difficult, but it's not as nice. And if you're looking at the output from models from multiple different packages to extract the same information, you might need to use different syntax. And so when you train your models using tidy models, you get this tidy output where, you know, your model output is arranged into rows and columns, and it's very easy to work with and extract information from. You've got there. Yeah, exactly.
Excellent. Well, we've talked a lot about different packages today in R, and you are a new author, Heaven Rees. You're going to be having your book coming out this month in March, on March 15th. It's focused on machine learning with R, Tidyverse, and MLR. For you and your experience...
It's a mouthful.
Well, at least it's not, what is it, R for mortals, but you know, we are all,
yeah.
We're all mortals here, but hopefully we will all do well, you know, in the fight against coronavirus. But, you know, gearing things back to your book, I mean, what was one of the most exciting things or enjoyable things about you publishing your book and becoming an author?
So one of the things was people actually starting to ask me questions about content in the book, because then I finally realized that people were reading it. So Manning do this thing called the Manning Early Access product, where basically, so you can see Meep there, where basically the book has been available to buy as an ebook for a few months already, and now the entire book is available. And as part of that, they have a book forum, and people can read the book there and can highlight mistakes that I've made even before the book has been finally proofread, which was a bit strange, and can ask questions on there. So I think that was particularly exciting because people were asking questions, which was nice because they wanted my opinion and understanding of things. And it also showed me that people have actually bought this book and it's actually a real thing, which is phenomenal. The other thing was, I guess, when the process that Manning goes through for producing a book is extraordinary. It's extremely robust. I wrote the book. It was read by, my editor, a technical editor, several people that were experts in particular areas. And then once they deemed that the book was in, or certain chapters were in good enough condition, it gets sent off to reviewers. And so it got sent off to, I think, like 18 people to read and then give me their feedback. And that was absolutely terrifying because you sort of put this content out there for people to read, and then suddenly, of course, you're open for to scrutiny and criticism. But it was very nice because when the reviewers came back, they came back with some very nice, helpful comments. But the feedback was overwhelmingly positive, which was very nice. Also, I can't wait to have an actual physical paper book in my hand, because of course at present it's just an ebook. So when I can finally hold the book in my hand, I think that will make it finally real. And I can't promise that I won't cry either. Like it's been a bit of a roller coaster writing it. It's taken me quite a long time, but I really do think that it's an excellent book. And I it sounds very braggy of me, and I don't mean it to be, because although I wrote the content, a huge number of people other than me have made the book very good. So I do think that people will learn a lot and get a lot from it. And if you don't, then contact me and I'll apologize. But I think even if people are not new to R and you're not new to machine learning, if you're interested in the MLR package, I think you would still get some benefit from it.
That's right. Even if people are not new to R, they'll learn a lot about R. See what I did there? I love the R programming language. I think it's making a huge comeback this year in 2020. And Heaven Rees, thank you so much for sharing everything that you're doing with Tidyverse, with MLR, and the whole Tidy ecosystem in your book, coming out March 15th, paper physical copies. Thank you for being with us on the Humane Podcast.
Thank you very much for having me. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Humane Podcast. What do you think? Did the show measure up to your thoughts on artificial intelligence, data science, future of work, and developer education? Listeners, I want to hear from you so that I can offer you the most relevant, trend-setting, and educational content on the market. You can reach me directly by email at david@humanepodcast.com. Remember to share this episode with a friend, subscribe, and leave a review on your preferred podcasting app, and tune in to more episodes of Humane.